Hi, I'm Abby. I'm a mom and a writer.
Hi, I'm Melanie. I'm a mom and a writer.
Hi, I'm Jenny. I'm a mom and a book coach.
Welcome to Mom Writes, where we aren't slick, we aren't fancy, but we are real. This podcast is all about our coaching journey, writing a book from start to finish. It's real life writing, done at the kitchen table or in our spare 15 minutes between work and school pickup. This is how we get it done. It's the dirty laundry behind writing with kids. If you're interested in more information about Author Accelerator and the same coaching program we use, visit Jenny's website at www.authoraccelerator.com.
All over the country, school bells are starting to ring and parents are buying new pens and pencils and notebooks, or in my case, 20 reams of paper, and sending their little lovelies off to school. This is like the spring of the educational world. It's the fresh start, the clean slate, a new beginning. Come August or September, many of us approach the new school year with a sense of hope that this will be the best year yet. This will be the year when we make the honor roll, make the lead in the school play, make the football team, insert whatever dream you want here. But what happens if you don't? What happens if you fail? That's what writer, former teacher turned professor, and dad, Luke Reynolds, talks about in his new book, Fantastic Failures. Luke has years of experience teaching kids during that most awkward of phases, middle school. He honestly shares about his own middle school experiences and how sharing and writing about them can help kids learn that failing is not the end of the world. As a matter of fact, failing is just one of the steps in succeeding. So, if you're like me, even though this advice is specifically geared towards middle school students, I think even adults can take it to heart.
Good morning, everyone. Hello, Author Accelerator Facebook page. It's Abby and Melanie from Mom Writes, and today we are bringing you an interview with Luke Reynolds. Luke, hello! Hey.
Good morning.
We've already had a great discussion. See, this is the only bad thing about doing a Facebook Live interview is when we podcast and we record it on Skype, we can just immediately start talking. So if we say good things, like we can still get it on. But when you have to wait for 11 o'clock to start the broadcast, sometimes it's tough. So we were just talking about thugnotes.com. I put it up on the screen. Everyone should check it out because my one regret is because Luke is a former middle school teacher. I'm a former high school teacher. Thugnotes.com could make any kid love literature, but the unfortunate thing is it's full of profanity and you cannot show it to a kid. So, you know,
so if you need help loving literature, you should go there.
if you who follow us on Author Accelerator need help loving literature,
probably not, but it's just an enhancement, you know, it'll enhance your life a little bit.
But Luke, today we're here and I'm going to let you give a little bio about yourself, but in general, just for our two viewers who have already tuned in, we are here today to talk about failure, which is actually, I think, a super exciting and interesting topic. So Luke, give us a little bio though.
Yeah. So, for me, failure runs really deep because I remember growing up and failing at a lot of things and wondering what's wrong with me. You know, why can't I get this right? Like trying out for the basketball team, not making it. Trying to be a writer in middle school and high school and not getting very good grades. I remember in high school, loved writing, loved English, and the highest grade I could ever get was a B+. So every essay would come back B+. And I had already had these fantasies of being a writer, but I thought the best I could get is a B+. I'm never going to make it as a writer. And I went through life thinking, you know, everyone else finds their sweet spot. And I haven't been able to find mine and sort of bouncing around trying to figure it out. And when I became a teacher, I realized a lot of my students felt that way, that they just couldn't couldn't be as good as they wanted to be. And so for me, the genesis of thinking about failure comes out of my own life experience, conversations with my brothers, but then also my time as a teacher, just thinking about how people struggle with failure and think I'm the only one that gets rejected. And so the more I research these people in Fantastic Failures, the more I realize that's our commonality. That's our humanity. We all are deeply rejected. We deeply struggle. We feel like we're alone. And that's the basis of being a human. And then from there, that's where we go, you know? And so, so for me, there's been a lot of rejection and failure and, morning, buddy.
My dogs always make sure I'm a failure at podcasting. Yeah. They can't keep their little mouths shut long enough. Yes.
They're real.
Well, so Luke wrote this fantastic book, which Melanie and I were lucky enough. Your PR lady sent us an ARC, and so we've been able to read it, even though it doesn't come out until September, right? But called Fantastic Failures, and you wrote it specifically. For middle grade. So you're a middle grade writer, which again, a man after my own heart here. But the thing that really struck me as I was reading this book was, I mean, it's written for kids. I mean, you speak to kids, your voice is for kids. You know, but it's so profound because it speaks to us too. It speaks to adults. I mean, these are lessons that I think we could work on them our whole life and never really fully embrace the idea of failure. And I just think what a brilliant way to, I guess, to address your own, you know, failures and your own views of failures than to have to teach someone else that failure is okay. I mean, you're a teacher, so you know, sometimes the best way to learn something yourself is to have to teach it to somebody else.
Amen.
And so, you know, writing this book and you know, reading it myself made me stop and think, how can I teach this to my kids? How can I be a better teacher to my own children to teach them that failure is okay? Like, I don't know, maybe it's a little late for me to learn, but it's not too late for them.
No, and that's so profound too, because the more I researched, and even when I would talk a lot with my middle schoolers about sometimes the best thing that can happen is for you to get a C minus on an essay. Or I remember my wife tells this great story about, she had this teacher in high school who challenged her not to get an A because she felt like she had to get A's all the time. And that sense of, we should experience what it's like to not always do great. And that relieves so much pressure and perfectionism. Mm-hmm. But just like you're saying, it was fascinating because I often think, and I don't know if you agree, Abby and Melanie, but I often think we end up writing the things we most need to read. And so I was like, I need to learn how to accept that I'm going to be rejected constantly. I'm going to fail a lot. And I need to keep taking risks. So one of the best things I could do is write about it. And almost like you say, if we really want to learn something, write it for others, teach it to others. And in that way, we sort of speak to our own souls, I think. So I think that's powerful. The downside of that, I think, is, you know, my own kids, I have three boys, and my own kids will often say to me, well, like, you know, like, when have you failed? So if I'm talking to them, like, hey, it's okay, buddy. Like, so you didn't do this right. No worries. Sometimes it takes 10, 20 times. They're like, well, Dad, tell me about when it took you 20 times to do something. And so it's one of those things where I think the more we talk about it, the more we have to be willing to share our own failures.
You know, just before my daughters were born, I can remember my husband and Melanie's husband, they both have masters in medical physics. Okay, so that right there tells you. They're pretty smart cookies. But I can remember when I was pregnant with my first daughter saying to my husband, you're never allowed to talk to our children about your experiences in middle school and high school. Because he graduated at the third from the bottom of 800 kids. Mean, what? 99% of the special ed kids at school graduated ahead of him. And so I said, you're never allowed to talk to them about that. But really what I have found now that my children are in school and they when they get hit with struggles is he's a better person to talk to them about what to do than I am, because I was one of those kids. I became a teacher because I loved school and I loved being a student.
We
need more teachers, Luke, like you, who understand the kids that struggle. I remember starting my job as a high school teacher, and somebody told me a kid did something in class, and one of the other teachers said, "Well, why don't you just give him detention?" And I went, "Wait, that's a that's real? Like, detention really exists?
We can do that?"
And she's like, "Yeah, we had it here when you were in school." And I was like, "No, you didn't." She goes, "Yes, we did. You just never got it, you know."
Never had to go.
But I think that's really important to honestly share our experiences, was one of the things I loved about how you started your book. So you started with two things that I love. Number one, you talked about yourself in middle school. And I thought, oh, that's so great that you remember enough about your experience being a kid and that you'll share it. I mean, because if it wasn't perfect, you said you ate a lot of candy and stole a lot of stuff. I got to hear more about that.
That's wild.
Well, that's awesome. Something I remember the first day I opened up to my own seventh graders about that, because, you know, I'm a big believer in setting goals and trying to do the best we can, and, you know, modeling kindness and trying to be authentic and all those things. And sometimes my own middle school students would say, like, "Mr. Reynolds, like, you never get angry, you never do this or that." And I said, like, look, we all have a lot of goals we're trying to do. But if you knew me back in middle school, you wouldn't recognize me. I go into stores and I shoplifted like crazy. I stole hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of stuff. And they're like, "No, you didn't, Mr. Reynolds. That's not right." I'm like, "Yes, I did. I swore all the time. I ate tons of candy. I was just a very different person." And lo and behold, my oldest brother is deaf. And I have four brothers. My oldest brother's deaf. And I just remember one day he knew I was going down a bad track. I was in seventh grade, and he just kind of came up to me and was like, "You with me, own thing." And he forced me to go for a run with him outside. And the two of us, he forced me to run 3 miles with him. And we started this relationship. And without him, I think I would have gotten into drugs, and I would have gone down, I would have continued that path of shoplifting and other things. And one of the things I believe, like when I was researching for the Fantastic Failures, you know, there's a whole lot of talk in educational circles about grit nowadays. Like, mm-hmm. you just got to teach kids to have grit. Just stick with it and everything's okay.
And how?
That was my big question, was like, grit is not enough. It's not just telling kids work hard and everything will be okay. It's also about having people who invest and care in us. So for me, if it hadn't been for my oldest brother, Chris, all the grit in the world wouldn't have helped me. And I think that's the reality of needing people to care about us, love us, be authentic with us, but then also sort of lead us. And then the hard work and the grit comes into play. So for me, that was huge. And I tell them that, you know, the middle school students, look for people in your life that you could say, "I need some help. Like, I'm alone. I haven't figured it out." And any adult will tell you that they've been there. They've made mistakes. They felt alone. Those kinds of things.
And I feel like in parts of your book, in different biographies of people, you made a point to point out that a lot of times these people didn't do it alone. They had help. You know, they had people in their lives who loved and cared about them too. And I just thought that was really important to emphasize that too. We were on a road trip when I was reading this, and I was reading some of them to my daughter, who's 7. So I kind of condensed it a little bit and made it a little easier to understand, but she, you know, she knows who some of these people are. And she was kind of shocked. I think that kids often see adults as kind of all knowing and not necessarily perfect, but like, we've got it all together, you know? Don't make mistakes. Yeah. And so she was just kind of shocked to hear that so many of these people struggled for so long.
And that's what I remember. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Rudy, which one of my, I'm not even a football player. I don't even know the rules of football, but I love that movie because this little guy and, you know, all about hard work and this mentor. But the janitor in the film who becomes a mentor to Rudy is Charles Dutton, the actor. And that was probably one of my favorite stories, where this was a guy growing up in a really rough area. He had been in fist fights. He had, thrown rocks at guys and put people in the hospital. And he was eventually put behind bars. And sometimes it's like this small moment where somebody does this kind thing. And he tells this story about a guy in the jail, just bringing the book cart around. And he had to pick a book. And he picked up this Broadway book of Broadway plays. And he started reading it. And Charles Dutton, at this point, no experience in acting and theater, he read these plays. And he said he felt like his heart was on fire. And that began his journey towards doing theater, and then he was on Broadway and had his own show. And just those kind of experiences make me feel like, you know, none of us, we can't do it alone, like you're saying. And I think we so often see the outcome and we're like, oh, this guy's on Broadway. He's got his own show. He must have just been in the pipeline all along. And no, it's always these strange mentors or strange moments of kindness that bring to life, like you're saying, what I think we could be. And I love kids being able to see that, like nobody gets a free pass. There's always somebody helping them or showing them a possibility.
But we all have this misconception that it was just easy for people. So like, you know, Mel and our other co-host who's not here today, Jenny, you know, we always say you walk into Barnes & Noble and you look at all these books and you think, oh, these writers just picked it up and started at page one and then wrote the end. And then it, you know, flew off the shelves at Barnes & Noble. Yeah. And that's all, you know, that's all there was. And so, you know, you come right out of the gate in your failure book and say, J.K. Rowling, you know, we all think, and it's so cute because you do, you write your opening paragraph for each chapter for each person is the story we all think we know about who they are. And it's so true because everyone I read, I was like, well, that is how it happened, right? But for the writers out there listening, I think many of us are familiar with J.K. Rowling's story because she's, let's face it, she's sort of like our benchmark in writing, which is, how are we ever going to get there? But, you know, she was rejected, you said, 13 times?
Yeah, it was the 13th publisher, was Bloomsbury, that took it on, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
But, can you imagine being one of the first 12 now?
Looking back, and that's the crazy thing about sort of reaching a goal. I think, you know, once it's reached and there are people watching, it's almost like it's impossible to look back and see, well, look, here's the whole story. We just get the, you know, even if you think in a movie, like I've often joked with friends about, you watch a movie and it's 2 hours. And even if there's some struggle in the movie, it's condensed to maybe 30 minutes, you know, or the montage, like they work so hard, but then they make it. And I think we come away psychologically and we think, oh, so it's about 30 minutes of struggle. And then I'll make it.
It's not that hard.
Yeah.
You mean you get up to go pee during the movie and you come back and the struggle is over?
And
I miss the montage.
Yeah. And the J.K. Rowling story is so powerful. And even like, you know, great writers like Harper Lee, I haven't found really any writers who have said, it just kind of.
It happened.
Dashed out this manuscript and it was off to the races.
I was at an SCBWI conference, Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And Jane Yolen did the keynote speech. And she had this line that was just fantastic. She said, I could paper my house with all the rejection letters I've received. And I thought, someone with as many wonderful books as Jane Yolen can paper her house in rejection letters.
All of a sudden you're like, I'm in good company.
I think that one of the really, and this was sort of one of the takeaways for me from your book, and my adult perspective was to sort of change the idea of failure and not see it so much as failure, but see it as one of the steps in succeeding.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And so now I guess, so part of the question is like, so how do we change this perception? How do we change it for ourselves? How do we change it for our kids?
Yeah. That's the biggest one, I think, where I think it's become almost a little bit like grit now. It's become somewhat popular to talk about failure and to talk about like making mistakes as normal. But I think the next level is the really hard part to get to. And I'll be honest, it's really hard for me. It's hard for all of us, is to start actually talking about our own failures and rejections often. And, you know, this is like the Facebook dilemma where we create an iceberg effect. Like, look, this is my beautiful, amazing family. Look, here is us all happy. And you know, the reality is starting not with everyone, obviously in a safe relationship and with people we trust, but to start talking really openly about like, look, this is where I failed as a dad. This is where I failed as a teacher. This is where I failed as a writer. This is where I failed as a friend, a brother. And to start talking about those, not as like, oh, I'm such a terrible person, but to start normalizing it, because the truth is we all experience deep rejection and deep failure, but we'll talk about the safe failures. Like I'll talk about failures I had 30 years ago, but ask me about how I failed yesterday and I didn't make a good choice.
It's a little too fresh for that.
Well, that was one of, when Melanie and Jenny and I started this podcast, one of the goals for us was, you know, Melanie and I, as new writers, as green writers, had these misconceptions about the process of writing a book. Yeah. We thought it was that you start at page one, you end at page 250, you write the end, and then it goes off to the publisher. But, you know, we wanted to be able, over the course of many, many episodes, to show the iterative process of what it takes to really write a book. And we had some pretty big failures. I believe on the very first podcast, Jenny said to me, I gave her my first 10 pages of the book that I had written. And one of the first things she said to me was, an agent would have never made it off page one.
You're like, great, let's start things off on the right foot.
So how do we fix it? I'm like,
you know what's so powerful about that too is seeing that as like that is the normal, and even I'd even go beyond normal. That's the beautiful process. Is, you know, for a while with our oldest son, when he would come home with school with anything less than perfect, it was like, oh, I don't want to try again because I obviously must not be good at this because I couldn't get it the first time. Mm. And retraining our brains to say that is completely normal. Like, even geniuses don't get things the first time. They need repeated attempts to look at it from different perspectives, and retraining our brains to truly believe that is normal. That's life. Mm. And then the most powerful thing is, I feel like sometimes the people who sustain their say writing or gymnastics, people who sustain their love of something are people who fail often at it early on. They learn to love it. And then it's almost like you can't get that love out of them. Whereas the people who often succeed very quickly, research tends to show they almost quit. It's almost like, well, I could do this very easily and very quickly. So what's there?
So the first time they hit a stumbling block, they think, I'm done. I'm no good at this anymore.
Yeah.
And isn't it similar when kids, and I've read a few things about this, when kids are just referred to as, you're so smart, you know, like, and they begin to see themselves like, this is an intrinsic personality trait. And then when they fail, they're like, oh, I'm not smart anymore. You know?
Do you know, one of the things that we've always said in our family is, well, smart girls keep trying. Smart girls try again. And not, you did that, you're so smart, but that didn't work out, we'll keep trying. Smart girls keep trying and you're a smart girl. And a little bit of a shift. And that's the funny thing, all of these things we're talking about are tiny little shifts in your brain. But overall, they add up to something really big.
No, that's so powerful. And you're right, it's such a small shift, but it activates this whole other region of the brain where we start thinking, it's okay to keep trying, to keep going. And I think the idea of trying something and that idea fosters more connection. Whereas I think when we tell kids, like, you are so smart, you are so talented, you are so good at basketball, it almost fosters an individualized focus where now it's just you against the world, because this is, where when you foster kids trying, it's like, hey, look at all these other people who are trying. Now you've got something in common. Yeah. And I remember on NPR listening to this beautiful interview with a record producer. And I forget his name, but he was talking about he had, you know, produced records for some of the biggest stars in the 60s, 70s and early 80s. And he said, you know what? There's one thing I've seen in common. Everybody who I've put on my label, they've ended up getting divorced. They've become bad parents. They've gotten into drugs. And so he said in his third decade, he started telling people before he signed them up, I'm going to sign you up. I'm going to offer you the deal, the whole shebang, tour, everything. But I want you to know if you take this contract, it will ruin your life. And they're like, no. He said every time they always said, no, not me. I'm different. And so they'd sign. And he said, sure enough, he'd watch their lives spiral out of control. Wow. But the powerful thing was he said, you know, they were so focused on the individual success that once they had that, it almost destroyed them, rather than if you're focused on the relationship, the connection, the community. Like for writers, I remember being so focused on just get the contract. And after years and years of not getting the contract, I learned to develop the friendships and, you know, with other writers. And those are the things that's actually what makes it meaningful, not the contract.
Well, can we talk about your writing journey? I mean, that's kind of a good segue into. Yeah. So tell us, you know, how, because you have two published books, or one published and one almost published. We're pre-ordering, right, at this point. Yeah. And so, but how did you get there?
So the first, it was definitely a lot of failure and rejection, but the first book I wrote was, I started writing for adults, and I wrote three novels for adults. I wanted to be, you know, literary fiction, adult writer. And so I wrote these three literary fiction novels, all of them rejected for probably 4 or 5 years, nothing happened. And I was thinking, I don't know if I'm ever gonna make it as a writer, my dream. And I was teaching seventh grade at the time. And I was in a school where we ran out of books. Our book room, it was, the school was struggling a bit. And in the book room, we literally had read everything that was in the book room. So we had no other books to read. And, but we had this cool grant from the state that allowed us to photocopy essentially for free as much as we wanted. So I was like, I'll write a book for my seventh graders to read. And, then we had this grant. So I was able to photocopy the book for free. So I wrote this book about a seventh grade kid, and I just wrote it for, you know, and tried to put all of their life experience into the book. And then I started realizing I love writing for middle grade students. That's way more fun than writing for adults. So that started the process of writing for kids. And so that book eventually, after 5 years and probably at least 10 solid rewrites, became my first novel, The Looney Experiment. And so, it was rejected like crazy. And I went to this conference, the Rutgers University one-on-one conference. Yeah. And very cool. And actually, and only from the help of a mentor, Jordan Sonnenblick, who wrote Drums, Girls, and Dangerous Pie, and a lot of other books, he recommended this conference. So I went, and that's where I met my future agent, Ami Joan Paquette. It was probably 10 years of rejection. And then finally she, you know, read a little bit of Looney Experiment. And then she offered lots of great revisions. And then eventually, but even then when she took me on, I'll never forget, she just didn't give up. But I think we had about 25 rejections for that novel. And then finally she found, after 3 years, she called and said, we've got a contract. So it was just rejection and failure at every step of the way. And but that was sort of the start.
Yeah. Wow.
So I didn't realize that you had a middle grades novel. I knew your PR lady sent us Surviving Middle School.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
She sent us Fantastic Failures. And
These two are with Beyond Words, Fantastic Failures, and Surviving Middle School. And then there's some other ones with different. So that one was with Blink. They're an imprint of Zondervan. And so it was some other ones with different publishers. Yeah. Okay. So, but every one is often been rejected multiple times before it found a home.
So did you ever have any middle school kids in your class reject it to your face?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do. That's the best thing about like getting, and for me, that was such a visceral moment because I wrote it and I was very honest. I said, look, we ran out of books, but I wanted you guys to have something fun. So I wrote, and I tried to load it up on all the things, you know, we're teaching, like hyperbole and, you know, metaphor, simile and all that. So I put a lot of that in, and but they were so honest. They're like, Mr. Reynolds, this would never happen. No, this is not true. Or they'd be like, we'd be reading as a class. They'd be like, whoa. This is not a good idea. This chapter, you should have stopped a long time ago. This is really boring.
So you were teaching them constructive.
Yeah. Well, you were teaching them literary criticism, which is
They were great literary critics when it came to their own teacher's work. Yeah.
That's funny.
But I think what I was hopeful about that experience too is I was able to talk to them about like, hey, so when you write something the first time, it should be pretty bad. Like Anne Lamott's, you know, oft repeated phrase, the shitty first drafts. Like we should just expect that when we get our first draft out, it's not going to be great. It's going to be bad. And then talking with people about it, having readers look at it, going back over and over and over, that's where it's at. That's the beauty. Plus, like we were talking about earlier, that's where relationship enters the picture. So, you know, when we're writing, it's a solo endeavor. But then when we've got good people and good friends we're talking with, all of a sudden the book becomes, well, it's not just mine. It's also
something bigger.
And I feel like every book shouldn't just have one name on it. There's, you know, like you probably feel the same, but my favorite thing to do is read the acknowledgement sections of books. And you see like it's armies of people who make a book happen. And that's cool. I think that's really cool.
It's also powerful for those kids to see that process of writing deconstructed and that, you know, it takes multiple drafts of something in order to make it good, which that carries over not just in kids' writing, but in other aspects of life as well. Because think of all the things you do that the first time you do it, it's no good.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time you baked chocolate chip cookies, Mel, were they as good as they are now when you bake chocolate chip cookies? You know, I mean, and it's not that baking cookies is necessarily that hard, you know, but you can mismeasure. You can grab the salt instead of the sugar. You can do like a whole bunch of different ways that you could go wrong. But the more you do it, the better you get, until you get to the point where, like, my grandmother making biscuits, she never measured anything. She knew how it was supposed to feel. But that didn't come immediately. That came after years and years and years and years of doing something and practicing and getting good.
And to your point about things like cookies, like, there's always an audience involved. There's other people you're connecting with. Like, hey, what do you think? How do they taste this time? Like you said, trying again. And one of the biggest areas I think we could do a great service to our kids, even at a young age, like 4, 5, 6 year olds, but especially middle school and high school, is modeling the idea that relationships aren't that way either. That friendships, you're going to have argument. I remember growing up, you know, my parents fought like crazy and they yelled. And I remember making a vow in high school, like, I will never have an argument with my wife. Like, God willing, I get married, I will just never have an argument. And I remember getting married and being like, we're both strong-willed and we had arguments. And I thought, man, I failed as a husband. I'm not doing it right. And then I realized, no, like, just because, you know, my parents may have fought in an unhealthy way does not mean that arguments are bad. It just means learning that in relationships, we are going to disagree. There are going to be problems. And I had so many, now I teach college, and even now I'll have kids come to my office, and older kids, I mean, young adults really. And they'll, you know, they'll have a relationship issue and they'll be like, I don't think he's right for me or she's right for me because we had this big argument. And I will often, you know, unless it's unhealthy, if somebody's hurting, obviously the other person emotionally or any, obviously not a good relationship, but a lot of times I'll say, no, an argument can be like oxygen for the relationship. You realize you aren't robots of each other. You need to think differently and explore that. That's totally fine. It's normal. And then be like, well, you know, Luke, did you argue with your wife? Like, yes, this morning we had an argument. It's totally fine. We love each other, but we're going to disagree. That's beautiful. It's okay. It's normal. And so many of the college students are like, really? I always thought, like, if you fall in love, it's just supposed to be like great. And it's like, no, it's not. And so anyway,
it's awful hard.
yeah. But the struggle is, I'm a big believer that the struggle is beautiful. That's what makes it cool is we're forced to go into these other gears when it's hard.
Yeah. No, I think it's important that kids learn from very early on that relationships take work and they're hard work too. And it's not always an easy, fun time.
No,
you're going to have arguments with people and you're going to disagree with people, but it doesn't mean that you can't work it out. So,
But imagine if you just coasted through life and you never had to work at anything. You never had to work at writing. You never had to work at love. You never had to work at anything. Where would be the joy in that at the end?
It's true.
Yeah. No, it's so true. And that's like that idea of like the record producer who said, you know, I'll sign you, but it's going to destroy you. I think sometimes when things are easy and success comes easy, I think that's more dangerous than the opposite, that it tends to destroy people. And the people who, I once had a writing teacher who said, I hope, as she told us in her class, I hope you don't get published too soon. And all of us are like, how could it ever be too soon? Like, today would be great. She's like, I hope you get rejected a lot before you get your first book published. But her idea was, if it happens too soon, it will kind of wreck your creativity. It will make you think in an unhealthy way. So it's a great point. Like, the joy comes from the relationships rather than the...
If you start at the top, there's nowhere to go but down.
Yeah.
So it's a lot different than working your way up to something.
Yeah.
So, go ahead. This is the only thing about Skype. I'm like...
Yeah.
Because there's always a little bit of a lag.
Yeah.
No, you go, Luke. This is your interview. You go.
Well, it always fascinates me how, with writers particularly, you know, when you read, because I also, other than the acknowledgments, it's always great to read the bios and some of the big writers who have really made it. And I don't mean to judge because they're obviously hugely successful, but it always kind of makes me smile when in their bios they'll say, you know, this person has sold like 450 million copies of his books, and they're translated into 157 languages. And, you know, these big success stories, and you almost wonder, like, is that in there to like, will it ever be enough? And, you know, does it have to be one more language or one more 100 million? Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you wonder, do they feel like it's enough, or do they have to continually prove themselves?
So, here's my last question. Yeah. For you. So Fantastic Failures is, just a recap for anybody who might have tuned in since we got started, is a book that Luke wrote that has a bunch of different, like, little biographies. Every chapter is another little biography of someone, their story as we know it, or as we think we know it, and then the real story behind all the things that happened to get them to their success, all the ways that things went wrong, mistakes that they made, ways they failed. So who failed to make it into your book? Is there anybody that you researched, but that it failed to make the cut into the end?
Oh, great question. That's a fabulous question. I mean, the honest answer is no. I mean, and this in a good way, like, when I researched for the book, I just started thinking of who are people that I think are pretty, you know, they've done cool stuff. They're pretty successful. And I remember thinking, but what if I find out they haven't failed much? Or what if I find out they've actually had a pretty good path? And the more I researched, I found out, like, everybody has this littered past of struggle and failure. And even if it hasn't been professionally, it's personally. Like, the people who seem to make it professionally pretty fast, they have some really rough personal lives and relational struggle, or you know, like, even a guy like John Gardner, a famous novelist, who's, you know, when he was young and ended up driving a tractor over his brother, it was an accident, but he grew up his whole life feeling like, what have I done? It was an accident, but he had to carry that shame around. So there's always struggle and rejection and failure and pain. So the honest answer is, the more I researched and found people, the more I said, this is a common human experience, that we struggle with pain and rejection and failure. And what makes it beautiful is finding people to lean on and to help us keep moving forward.
Even if you end up like Vincent Van Gogh.
Even
who never saw success in his own lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering. I was like, I wonder what Abby thought of that chapter. Yeah.
So what Luke doesn't know that Melanie has experienced firsthand is my extreme love of Vincent Van Gogh.
Yeah.
I cannot stand in front of one of his paintings without sobbing almost uncontrollably. Yeah. And I don't think Melanie believed me when I said, okay, hey, let's go into the museum. As long as I don't see a Vincent Van Gogh, we're going to be doing good. And then I
just tell one before me and I didn't make it in time. I was like, wait, stop. No, I was too late.
I rounded the corner and I'm like, whoa. And the poor docent, Mel, do you remember? He walked over and he didn't know what to do with me. He was like, did you just break up with your boyfriend? Like, what happened?
It's okay. She warned me about it. It happens. I thought that was one of my favorite chapters, actually, when I read that, because I didn't know all of that stuff about him. And I was just, I don't know, I had a deeper appreciation for him, even after reading that. So,
And the self-doubt. And I don't know if that's why you feel like emotionally you connect so much, but the level of emotion he experienced, the pain, the depression that he suffered, we have to believe that that is what makes his work beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think so. Mm.
So, well, Luke, I'm so glad you came by to talk to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I love getting to know both of you and talk together. And and I wish you the very best on your journey with writing, and hopefully we can stay in touch.
Yeah. Well, Luke, you hang on for 2 seconds. We're going to say goodbye to the audience, but hang tight. So, Author Accelerator people, we will see you again soon. You can watch a new episode, or you can listen to a new episode of Mom Writes coming up on Monday. Mel, you're in the hot seat coming up on Monday. It's the episode where you had all those really, speaking of failure, you had really horrible edits.
Yes.
You remember?
Was that over Christmas?
Yeah, it was over Christmas, and you had those bad edits. And so,
I love that. That's great.
So tune in on Monday, everybody, to see Mel fail. Okay, so bye, Author Accelerator people.
Bye. Goodbye.
If you are listening to this podcast in real time, today's episode may have sounded familiar. If you like Author Accelerator's public Facebook page, you might have gotten a notification that we had gone live. So Melanie, Jenny, and I are starting to record our podcast interviews and some of our coaching episodes right there on the Facebook page so that you can watch the magic while it happens. And Luke was our very first live interview. So if you haven't already, hop on over to the Author Accelerator Facebook page where you will find announcements, our Facebook Live events, and Jenny's Ask Me Anythings, where once a month you can ask Jenny any of your craft-related questions and she will answer them. And in addition, if you are listening to this in real time, you can also find out about the Author Accelerator Scholarship for Writers of Color, where Author Accelerator is awarding a year of book coaching to 3 writers. You can find all the details about the scholarship on the Facebook page or on our website at www.authoraccelerator.com/scholarship.